Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins, and today we're delighted to have Dr. Mark Kosheski, PhD, who is the Father Michael I. English, SJ Professor of Medical Ethics at Loyola University. He's also the Director of the Nice Wanger Institute for Bioethics and Health Policy at Loyola. Mark is the past president of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities and a fellow of the Hastings Center. He's a dedicated bioethics educator known for having created two of the major online graduate programs in bioethics. Dr. Kosheski's current interests include attention to bioethical issues related to the recent wave of immigration to the United States. His writings argue for a severing of any relationship between healthcare and immigration status. He created the Sanctuary Doctoring Program with Dr. Johanna Mejia Speck and Amy Blair to provide resources to physicians in supporting their immigrant patients. He was the catalyst for Loyola University's Chicago's Stritch School of Medicine becoming the first medical school in the nation to welcome applicants from DACA recipients. For this work, Mark has received numerous awards. Well, thank you for being on Bioethics in the Margins. You were recently awarded the IAB Award for Bioethics Service in the Face of Challenges. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, well, thank you for having me here today, and thank you for asking about that. It's a great honor to have received that award, in that it's a little bit unusual award because it is about some action related to bioethics as well as scholarship. And of course, that's very Aristotelian, that the goal of ethics is actually to do something. And basically, it recognized a track record of collaborating for justice for immigrants, as you mentioned, the Stritch effort to bring DACA recipients into our medical school and the Sanctuary Doctoring Program to support undocumented patients in physicians' offices. I'm kind of a little bit of an old guy, and so I think I was being acknowledged for helping to bring immigration-related issues into the mainstream of discussion in the bioethics community, where it's sort of been seen as a sidelight. And yet it's a very important issue because it's not going away anytime soon. And it's important that we see that word sanctuary as central to the bioethics mission. That sanctuary is a way, when we think about it, it's a way of severing public safety and public health from immigration status. And we're all safer and healthier if we do that. And so I really think that's what the award was about this time.
We know you've done all this work addressing policy challenges related to immigration and advocated on behalf of immigrants. But today we invited you to speak about an article you wrote for Health Affairs titled, "When Nonprofit Healthcare Behaves Badly, the Case for Mission Leaders as Ombudsmen." And we will be posting that on our website along with Dr. Kosheski's other work. So can you tell us what spurred you to write this article?
Sure. As many people know, there was a series of New York Times articles in late 2022 or early 2023 about the behavior of some nonprofit healthcare systems. And that series really highlighted a series of scandals in an effort to weave a narrative of indifference to their nonprofit mission of these large healthcare systems. And the claim really being that this idea of nonprofit mission had just become window dressing, that in fact they were behaving like unscrupulous for-profit institutions with really doing sort of reverse Robin Hood things where they were using profitable programs that's institutions of theirs in communities that were underserved and feeding those that margin to better served communities, unscrupulous billing and collection practices from Medicaid patients and uninsured patients. And as I read these articles, they were concerning to me, And you know, it was not my that had not been my general experience of nonprofit healthcare over the years, and so I wanted to kind of tease some of this out. Yet at the same time, as I started to talk to a lot of my friends in healthcare administration in nonprofit healthcare, they would respond not by really directly addressing some of these concerns, but by telling a different narrative, and what I've come to call the narrative of peril, that really spins the nonprofit healthcare systems as a bunch of embattled good guys, so to speak, that are just trying to survive in an environment where the very existence of nonprofit healthcare is threatened. And this struck me as a little bit concerning because while these were important considerations they were talking about, they were not directly addressing the kinds of issues that were being raised by these articles. And it struck me as a, when you're really spinning an existential narrative, you can start to use that to justify almost anything. And that was kind of concerning to me. And so I wanted to really see if we could think about how we could focus better on the mission of nonprofit healthcare.
So just to clarify for our listeners, our understanding is that nonprofit hospitals, which make up more than half of all non-federal acute care hospitals in the US, are non-governmental nonprofit hospitals, and they receive various tax exemptions, federal, state, and local tax exemptions. And in exchange for these exemptions, the hospital is required to provide charity care and other benefits to the community in which they operate. And there are some estimates that these savings in total are up to $24.6 billion. And I'm getting those figures from the Center for American Progress Analysis of Hospital Financial Data. So do you think that there's evidence that nonprofit hospitals are sort of increasingly straying from their missions in recent years? And what do you think might be driving that?
Yes, well, you know, it's hard to come up with a single metric that can tell us this kind of thing. There's not one good performance indicator that can tell us this. You know, some of the critics of nonprofit healthcare, like Senator Bernie Sanders, will point to decreasing amounts being spent on charity care for uninsured patients. Yet that's not a particularly good performance indicator because there are fewer and fewer uninsured people all the time. For instance, as the as Medicaid has expanded to more and more states, so when the Affordable Care Act first rolled out the Medicaid expansion in 2014, only half the states in the United States accepted it. So that left 25 states that hadn't. We're now up to 41 states that have accepted. Each year, a couple more seem to do so. So that keeps shrinking the number of uninsured, and will keep shrinking the amount spent on charity care for uninsured patients. So that shrinking number doesn't tell us very much about it. And so we have to try to look around for other things. And so it becomes very anecdotal, as in the New York Times article, which really highlighted a lot of scandals, some of which were pretty clearly terrible things happening, some of which it seemed they were just throwing a lot of things at the wall that maybe wouldn't hold up under further scrutiny. Yet I think we can all probably agree in nonprofit, those of us who are near nonprofit health systems, that things certainly feel different. That morale is lower among all the providers. They're feeling a lack of focus on mission in their daily work, and they're feeling more harried in their day-to-day efforts. That there's more turnover among these providers. That there is a certain loss of feel of mission in institutions that bears out some of this concern. And when one tries to talk a lot about new mission-related activities to reach out to communities, it can be very difficult to get the attention you need. One tends to think that we are probably at an inflection point for nonprofit health systems.
Oh, very interesting. And I know that you mentioned a particular concept in your article, and the concept, and I believe the pronunciation is this, ombudsman. Am I correct in that pronunciation?
Sure, ombudsman.
And in this particular term, can you explain the use of that concept of ombudsman that you highlighted in your article and the significance of why this could be a possible model of checks and balances when it comes to nonprofits and healthcare.
Sure. Well, the issue, it seems, in the narrative of peril that I was talking about that the nonprofits are telling us, is that so many forces are converging to create a crisis for them. That there's shrinking reimbursements from the various insurers. There's competition for profitable service lines, so that, you know, if you have a profitable cardiac service, you could use that to subsidize other less profitable care, like inpatient psychiatric care. But then competitors are coming into your region and spinning off and creating freestanding cardiology clinics. And so you lose some of that profitable service line. So as your margin keeps shrinking, is under competition. And I should add with that also assumption of greater risk, as insurers are now sharing risk for outcomes with the large health systems, there's a kind of pressure on these health systems. And so they need enormous amounts of capital so they can survive in these kinds of situations and weather shockwaves like the pandemic when it hit us, and a sudden burst of inflation a couple of years ago, and things like that. Because if you're operating on a 3% margin and suddenly there's 7% inflation, you've got trouble, right? And so it's really pushed for a corporatization of healthcare. So the systems are consolidating. So you're getting larger and larger systems, health systems, less local control of the delivery of healthcare. There's a lot more size and a lot more corporate leadership, a lot less physician leadership than there used to be in healthcare. And so as this corporatization happens, there's an erosion of the traditional culture in nonprofit healthcare. It's one of the sayings that I love that some of my friends in healthcare leadership say is culture eats strategy for breakfast. And so as the culture is being eroded, becoming more of a corporate culture, and a business culture with outside consultants, national business consultants. They're the same consultants that consult for for-profit as well as nonprofits. We need a counterweight to that cultural erosion. And so you can go in a couple of directions with as you try to create that counterweight. But one is to have a person who is responsible for overseeing, making sure that nonprofit mission is kept front and center. And so, you know, ideally what you would want is your chief executive officer, your CEO, to be your chief mission officer too, that's really pushing the not-for-profit mission. But they're engaged in that business strategy and are part of that corporatization culture. And so the idea is to elevate a person, a mission leader, as I term it, to this role of ombudsman who oversees the nonprofit mission. And so that even the CEO is subject to the oversight of the ombudsman who monitors for different kinds of things. For instance, incentives in the CEO's contract, right? Because incentives in contracts are typically just business incentives, things like margin and market share and all of those kinds of things are in there. But that the ombudsman could really monitor for incentives that are mission related, that are for efforts related to building equity in the community and social justice and all of the things we associate with nonprofit healthcare traditionally. And it's an effort to counterbalance, as I say, the corporatization of medicine and that culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, of course, if the culture is corporate, the main incentive is to gain profits. It's not really humanistic in its core. So having incentives like, well, yes, you gain a certain amount of percentage or money. However, you could gain more money, and I hate to sound crass, but sometimes you have to provide incentive in order for corporate structures to actually do humanistic, more culturally based things. So that definitely, it's definitely a probable approach moving forward. Are there any other particular models or approaches to incentivizing nonprofit hospitals to do the right thing? I know you mentioned to have ombudsman as well. have stipulations within contracts to say if you do more humanistic things, do more culturally based, community based things, you also get, you know, whatever particular compensation out of that. Are there any other ideas for those who are listening that are CEOs of hospitals that have leadership positions in hospitals who are unfortunately bogged down by the corporate model that we could try to make better incentives and change in nonprofit healthcare settings?
Sure. And basically, it always comes down to two kinds of things that you can try to do. One is to focus on performance indicators. You know, that people always like to talk about key performance indicators or KPIs, as they call them. And you can have a sort of inventory of key performance indicators. How much money is spent on uncompensated care for people who are underinsured or Medicaid patients? What is your payer mix? Are you taking in people with insurance that is not as profitable, such as Medicaid and Medicare, as well as private insurance? I should probably just add it for a moment. It's a little bit of a digression that, in a sense, the context of this, though, is we have a little bit of a broken system that is incentivized towards inequity. And so we are looking to the nonprofit health systems to try to be a little bit of a wedge against that broken system. And so we're asking them in some sense to do a very hard, if not an impossible task, right? But nevertheless, that is what they are charged with. For instance, when I just was just talking about the two kinds of insurance that are public, Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare for seniors reimburses at higher rates than Medicaid, which is insurance for people who have incomes of less than 135% of the federal poverty level, right? And that that reimburses at a lower rate. Now, the first 2 years of the Affordable Care Act, the government actually reimbursed both at the same rate. They elevated the reimbursement rate for Medicaid to incentivize people to take Medicaid patients as well. Why shouldn't Medicaid patients always reimburse at the same rate as Medicare patients, right? Why should we build in a disincentive to take poorer patients into the system? And so, nevertheless, that exists. And so you can have a key performance indicator that makes sure that the payer mix of a large not-for-profit system takes in its share of, you could set a level of share for Medicaid patients and that kind of thing. And you can look at the community investment figures and, because health equity is about more than just medical care, right? Procedures in a health system. And many health systems have done wonderful, innovative things. Like they realize that homeless patients bounce back into their hospital regularly. And so some have actually invested in working with local homelessness agencies to build subsidized housing in their community for these people who are frequent patients in their ER, and they place them into this kind of subsidized housing. And so those kinds of expenses aren't the traditional health care that we think of, but they improve the health of the community, and they promote health equity in that community, that the worst, the least well-served are better served. So there can be measures like that that are monitored and targets set for that. And right now, nonprofit healthcare systems produce reports on that. They're required by the IRS to produce a community benefits report every year. And they talk about all the monies that they've spent on these kinds of community benefits. And so setting targets for that, ambitious goals for those kinds of things, can help to improve that. And again, incentivizing the leadership contract so that leadership is measured by how well it does on promoting those kinds of endeavors. So we can have those kinds of performance indicators along with monitoring for other kinds of the absence of negative indicators, like unscrupulous billing practices and things like that. Things that are seldom talked about, though, is employee morale, right? I mean, I do think this is the perhaps an undertapped measure of how well the nonprofit mission is, an institution being faithful to the nonprofit mission. Are the providers feeling a part of a idealistic project to improve the health of their patients and their communities? Or are they feeling like fungible assets that can be hired or laid off as at will? And in fact, we've seen this recently with nurses for decades have been treated as if you know, they are just fungible assets that can be hired or let go at will. And now we've seen them gain power by going to private nursing agencies. And so hospitals are in trouble hiring nurses. So they're paying much higher staffing costs to these agencies now for these nurses. And so we can go back to indicators of investment in one's staff, you know, long-term educational benefits, things like that, that have all been cut for years now, slowly, piece by piece, and look at those kinds of performance indicators. But then the other possibility is, as the ombudsman model kind of talks about, think about the personnel kinds of approaches to this. And so really thinking about the composition of leadership of a nonprofit institution. Very recently, there was a nice article in the JAMA Open Network by Jill Horowitz from UCLA, and she started to talk about empowered local nonprofit hospital boards, so that as this we're getting this more corporatized national health systems that our hospitals are all merging into, to empower local boards to oversee the local institutions and provide feedback and input as to those efforts, so that when a system starts to do a sort of reverse Robin Hood, where they're using assets from a system, a hospital in a underserved neighborhood, where they're usually closing services, they start closing non-profitable service lines and leaving open only those that are able to generate a margin. If they generate a margin, that should be plowed back into that local community. And so if you empower a local board to oversee the local operations, then they can have some input into these kinds of things and help us oversee community investment. Now, of course, this is all tricky because one of the things that I think is behind this is that the virtue theorists have it right in philosophy, that in ethics, that, you know, there's always a rule-based ethics that tries to come up with rules and stipulate what everything we should do. But it's always hard to come up with specific enough rules to really enforce that and get the kind of behaviors from people we want. A lot of life comes down to having some general ideals and values we want to institute. But then the particulars are always very particular, that we need people of goodwill and good judgment in place who then help guide us to achieve those ideals in practice. And so so these more personnel-oriented approaches like an ombudsman or empowered local nonprofit hospital boards are really about trying to get those people in. And, you know, and rolling more healthcare professionals into those leadership roles, so that as we've corporatized healthcare away from physician leadership and nursing leadership into more business-oriented people, to make sure that those people have as peers, people who are caregivers, who are physicians, nurses, and the people who understand the on-the-ground realities of caring for patients. So that's really your two models, is the performance measures and the personnel measures.
Oh, thank you. Definitely other really legitimate approaches, I think, to alleviate this money first, greed first type of mentality. Another question before I turn it back to Amelia, I know she also has some other thought-provoking questions for you. Are nonprofits all bad? I know that this is a really negative particular aspect for nonprofits, However, do you feel that there's still a place for nonprofits, or we're so far removed from the main goal of nonprofits to really be community-based? Because if not all, the majority of nonprofit hospitals are turning to this corporate culture, this corporate structure.
You know, I have to believe that there is a place for nonprofits, and I think maybe there's only a place for nonprofits. I mean, part of what's driven the narrative of peril is that you've got nonprofits swimming in the water with sharks that are for profit, right, and that are only profit based, and so the idea that one has to compete in those waters so that one can generate enough margin so that you can continue the one's mission is part of the problem here. And so, I think that we want to be as supportive as we can be of nonprofits, but again, try to ask them to be faithful to their mission. And, you know, I think part of what we want from them isn't just delivering X dollars of care to underserved communities, but we want them to go back to upholding an inspiring vision of healthcare for us, right? I mean, when you think about the caregivers that we've known, you know, I work in a medical school. The stories that students tell of why they wanted to be a physician was because of, you know, great actions that they witnessed of caregivers who cared for people at vulnerable times for their loved ones, went above and beyond the call of duty. And that's the vision of healthcare that I think we still believe in. We believe in healthcare as a vocation. And we want institutions that foster those vocations, those callings to treat people and help people at their most vulnerable moments. And nonprofits are still our last best hope for that. You know, it's really that is vision isn't really going to be inspired by the for-profit world. And so we want to go back to thinking of those leaders. There's no going back to some extent from the large health systems anymore. But we want the leaders of those systems to be thinking about what they want to hold forth. They want to be heroes for having a big, bold vision of healthcare, of changing lives, of these healing institutions that in which work these remarkable professionals, and that they foster the professionalism and the vocation of those professionals. So yeah, I definitely am not arguing to give up on nonprofits. If anything, I think what we're asking for is a big, bold vision for them.
Well, thank you for mentioning about the morale of employees in healthcare institutions, because I think there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that employees are fed up with leadership and feel that they're not delivering what they had hoped to do when they set out to become, clinicians. And they feel that they're not necessarily serving the patients that they had initially anticipated. I think another issue is, CEO salaries that, have got increasingly large, and certainly in comparison to many of the employees. And sometimes it's difficult to look at nonprofits and see these very large CEO salaries and then care not necessarily being provided to patients that may be maybe needy or marginalized.
Sure. And you've actually said a lot of things, Professor Barwai, so I'm going to, if I can pick apart a few of them in there. The CEO salary issue is often very interesting, because when I mention this to some of my friends who are healthcare executives, they'll often say, that's really a red herring, because, that we pay our CEOs what the market will bear. And in the end, even though it sounds like a lot of money, hundreds of thousands to several million dollars, there's not that much healthcare that could be delivered for if we cut them in half, even, And I tend to feel like they miss the point that you're trying to make here, which is a twofold, I think. One is that If you are working for an institution that's a nonprofit healthcare system, you want a culture that says, yes, we are all living vocations to try to serve the community. And that means that we don't just make what the market will bear, no matter how ridiculous those sums of money are, right? And in recent years, salaries of the people at the higher end of the salaries of the spectrum have really gone disproportionately, become much more disproportionate to those at the other end of the spectrum. And so the idea that a CEO of a health system should be very well compensated because the market does require that to get that talent, but several hundred thousand dollars might not be outrageous, but that multiple millions of dollars just isn't the culture we want to foster. And, I mentioned Senator Sanders having an idea I don't agree with earlier about measuring everything by charity care. He's recently introduced a bill that has some more interesting ideas about the CEO pay and what multiple of the lowest paid people in a health system it would be allowed to be before they put a very high excise tax on it. And that makes sense both from a symbolic cultural view, as well as we do know that income inequality is actually a social determinant of health, right? That when that gap between the high end and the low end is too wide, it leads to an unhealthier community. When you narrow that gap, you get a better result in terms of the health of the community. So it's symbolic, but it's also real. And so things like that are very important. And I think need more attention. It shouldn't just be so easily dismissed. When it comes to health equity in general, though, as I mentioned, there are many good efforts being made and we don't want to undersell the efforts that have been made that are in people's community health needs assessments and in their community benefit reports and all the things they did. And when we talk about community benefit, we're talking about that the health system has to do something that helps people in the community, not just their patients, that it has to be available to a defined population in the community. So when they do a vaccination program or a mobile unit to treat pediatric patients and vaccinate children, those are community benefit kinds of programs. And many do many of those things to promote health equity. But of course, it is a big, difficult thing to actually produce equity because many things like income do play into to the health statuses of people. And so, and the hospital or the health system can't change that easily. Now, there are approaches that are being taken. Some have talked about anchor hospital models and anchor hospital strategies for a hospital to recognize that if it's located in an underserved community, to set its targets for things like diversity of the staff, hiring targets from the local community, targets for community investment through things like nutrition programs and housing programs and things like that, and can contribute quite a lot to the equity of a community. Now, of course, if you're a hospital located in a wealthier community, the anchor hospital strategy doesn't really fit. So and that's where there can be cross-subsidization within large systems where the hospitals located in wealthier communities can cross-subsidize the hospitals within its system that are in that are more these anchor kinds of facilities. But again, that needs to be something that becomes part of the mission, an implicit part of the mission. And we actually hear less about cross-subsidization in recent years. And again, why I think we're at an inflection point on those kinds of things is because we've had a couple of years where all the health systems lost a lot of money due to those two big shock waves that came through with the COVID pandemic, in which lots of people who were used to present for the more profitable kinds of healthcare stopped showing up because they weren't coming into the hospital, and more care was being delivered on the end of the spectrum that loses margin. And then followed that by inflation. And as I mentioned, if all those insurance contracts assume 3% growth, and in fact you get 7% inflation, all your margin is eroded. So we saw these huge health systems losing billions of dollars. However, we're now recovering from that. And so now is the time to think again about that mission and that mission of equity. And so, I want to stay optimistic about this. If there's a will to do this, it can be done.
You've also written about the role organizational ethics can play in supporting mission leaders. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Sure. All the way back in 2006, with my colleague Patrick McCruden, we wrote an article about mission leaders, because there was a lot of talk about whether hospital ethics committees should get into the business of overseeing these kinds of more large-scale business decisions. And we didn't really think that they typically had the expertise for that kind of thing, and that it would be getting out of their waters, swimming depths that they're not really accustomed to. And we did push on the idea of the mission leader role, which I developed later in the ombudsman piece. But in Catholic health systems in particular, there used to be, the sponsoring orders of nuns typically, or sometimes of priests that founded a hospital or health system. And they would really oversee the mission role of the health system. But as there are fewer and fewer nuns and priests, those roles have been professionalized in the mission leader in Catholic health systems. And that mission leader, we saw as having great potential to have a person who was really steeped in the heritage of the charitable mission and the ethics of the institution, sitting at the table with all the corporate leaders, and promoting that nonprofit mission, we thought would be something that had great potential. And it has been shown to have great potential. But over time, what I think has happened, because again, that article goes back to 2006, mission leaders have gotten their own performance indicators that they're measured on. And those are often oversee the clinical ethics operation, like bedside ethics, case consultation, and pastoral care in the facility, and some formation programming, about the charitable mission that they do for the other leadership. And they are judged on those kinds of things, and become more identified with the soft side of ethics and not so much the business side. And they're seen more as akin to ethicists and pastoral care types. And so there's a kind of they've been sort of pushed to stay in their lane, so to speak, on the soft side of ethics. And there's the issue of being taken seriously then when it comes to the business decisions. So they are sometimes not really at the table for the kinds of strategies to increase margin that we've been talking about that can get out of hand. And they really are not proven to be a counterweight to the national consulting firms that are hired by these systems. And so, the idea of this kind of formation programming holds some potential to continue to steep the leadership in the values of the traditional values of the institution. But of course, that's after the fact intervention, right? Because these leaders have already been hired, and they're hired for their business acumen. And then to say, okay, and here we're going to put you through this sort of orientation program to this, the more charitable mission. It can have limited effectiveness. And so increasingly what we have to talk about, I think, is hiring for mission. The leader you're choosing is because they're the kind of leader who doesn't need as many millions of dollars to lead that institution and has a vision for nonprofit healthcare.
Just to add to those comments, there is also an important role for the Board of Trustees or the Board of Governors in shaping the way a hospital is following its mission.
Now, you've put your finger exactly on it, right? That in the end, this is about the right people in all of these leadership positions, right? Because if you stock your board of directors and trustees with people who really think the only thing that's actually real, in quotes, is the financial performance aspect, then you're going to get what they're asking for, right? You're going to get an organization that is just focused on the financial performance, right? And so you must put people on those boards that, in fact, understand the mission and the vision as well.
No, absolutely. And I think that the initiative that you are part of, the as project manager at Loyola University Chicago School of Medicine, and I know that you, as my colleague mentioned earlier, it was the first medical school in the nation to welcome applicants from DACA status. My question is, and this is really a topic that, usually we don't talk about, how about a charity care in regards to immigration? How does that work if a particular migrant that is not a citizen from a particular country, or we could say in America, comes and they need health care? Do hospitals actually provide charity care for those individuals, or there are an array of complexities based off of their immigration status?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And one of the things about, we talk about our healthcare system, it isn't really a system at all. It's a patchwork, and it's a patchwork with a lot of holes in it, right? And so as more states accept the Medicaid expansion, there are fewer uninsured people, but the people who are always left out of that are undocumented immigrants. They're simply not eligible for any federal benefits from the federal government. And so often the remaining uninsured in the state after the Medicaid expansion are predominantly undocumented immigrants. The statistics tell us, and these are always estimates, about half of the undocumented community have insurance and the other half do not. They've gained it through employment or some other way over time. But what does that other half do? Well, there's a patchwork of things available to them for primary care. They sometimes can go to federally qualified health clinics, which are able to deliver care on a sliding scale model. And I should say we're really expanded tremendously under the presidency of George W. Bush, who really gave that quite a boost. This is neither a Democrat nor Republican issue. It's a human issue. And so there's some primary care available to them. That way, if you're not near a fairly qualified health clinic, it can be very hard for them to obtain primary care. Often the emergency room becomes their only access to health care. And so under the federal law called EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, emergency rooms at nonprofit health systems have to receive all patients and treat them until they're stabilized. So that often becomes their point of access. And often is one of the differences between nonprofits and for-profits. For-profit systems usually don't have an emergency room because they don't want to have people for whom they're going to be uncompensated coming in. And so that's still part of what we look to nonprofits to do. And so that's often the way. But then for more chronic care becomes a problem because hospitals have to treat them through the emergency room till they're stabilized. But when they're not non-emergent anymore, there's not really an obligation under the law to treat. And so that is where charity care policies come in. And so, nonprofits often have these. Of course, it's complicated because you have to recognize them as eligible for charity care, get them enrolled in those kinds of things. People don't like to take free stuff. Contrary to popular belief, people prefer not to take free care. And so very often people will be reluctant to come in, but that can be at one point of access. But of course, that's dependent on the generosity of the charity care policies at the particular institutions. So it becomes a very difficult patchwork for undocumented immigrants. And it really is quite unfortunate because this affects the health of all of us. And we had a moment of clarity during the pandemic early on when we realized everybody's health affected everybody else. If you didn't get tested and isolate when you were sick, if you didn't get treatment when you were sick, if when the vaccines became available, you didn't get vaccinated, you not only put your health at risk, you put other people's health at risk, right? And, you know, and many of these people were exactly the, in quotes, essential workers that we looked to keep our grocery stores open, to keep our deliveries flowing, all of those things. And so it really is unfortunate that we deny access to all the regular benefits of the system and force them into these compartments like emergency rooms, charity care, and things like that, when in fact we would be better off, as I mentioned at the outset, by severing the tie between healthcare and immigration status. That's the only rational approach to keeping everybody in our communities healthy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm also curious regarding DACA medical school students. Do they have healthcare coverage through, like, you know, in the undergraduate level, students have some form of healthcare through whatever institution they are enrolled in? Is that the same model in medical schools, or is it something different?
Yes. Well, students who have Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, which was created by President Obama in June of 2012, are given a 2-year reprieve on any action on their immigration status, and they are given a work permit. So they have the ability to be out of the shadows and to be working lawfully, which is what enabled us to take them into medical school so that they could, because with the work permit, they could go on to residency. Because after you finish a medical school, you have to go train as a resident. But that's a job. You're actually employed by the hospital that's training you. And so they needed that work permit. And that enabled this pathway, which we're thrilled about, because it diversifies our physician workforce. And medicine is terribly non-diverse, I should say. We are underrepresented minorities that are very represented among our patient population and in our communities, but who need physicians who can deliver culturally concordant care. And also, in our medical school, having DACA recipients here, they're able to make our other students more culturally aware and culturally proficient and able to treat those communities. So as you mentioned, yes, they then are able to get student health insurance. And because of DACA, they can get the same health insurance from their employers when they go on to residency. What they can't get is a federal student loan because they are still considered undocumented immigrants and cannot access any federal benefits. So one of the things we had to do was to work to create loan partners who would give private loans to these young people. And over the course of the 10 years we've been doing this, we have more, I should say 12 years that we've been doing this, we have eventually created reliable loan partners who will now provide medical school loans to DACA recipients at medical schools around the country.
Oh, that's excellent. And I don't know if you heard of Dr. David Kuntz. He is part of Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine here in Nutley, New Jersey. They also have a program called the Minds Program. He also was a guest on Bioethics in the Margins. And this particular program aims high school students, trying to get them at an early age from all diverse backgrounds, ethnicities, and races to be interested in becoming medical doctors. So it's more of like the STEM track as well. So kind of reminds me of these different models trying to diversify medical education, which, as you said, is in dire need of diversity. You know, we live in a multi-pot, as we call it, of a country. So therefore, the physicians and nurses should reflect the actual society that it serves, right? That they serve. So excellent. And my last follow-up question with this wonderful program is, can you share how you achieve this and talk about the success of the program as well as the broader implications, which you sort of did, talking about diversifying this medical pipeline for physicians of training dreamers in medical schools? Are there any particular metrics or data that you have recently seen or will see regarding the impacts of this particular program?
Well, thank you for asking that. Since we opened our doors to DACA recipients, we matriculated 51 students, and 38 of them have graduated, are now either in residency or fellowships, or we now have a handful who are actually practicing physicians, attending physicians at communities. And they are, as you would expect, often serving the least served communities. They feel that as a personal mission. And so we're seeing high quality physicians going into places that really need them and reaching back. That these are very engaged alumni who reach back to our medical school to try to mentor students who are coming through now and help them understand the need and the mission. And as I say, the biggest trick to that, you know, because fortunately, other medical schools around the country kind of caught on after a few years of us doing this. They realized that, in fact, this was a huge source of diversity and resiliency. You know, because one of the things I always say about undocumented students is that, you know, well, I was a first generation college goer, and I did, you know, we didn't have that term back, but I just felt like I didn't fit in when I went to college. But I was a white heterosexual male, and so I got a lot of reinforcement. Every time I did something good, people patted me on the back and said, "Oh, Mark, you can be anything you want to be," even though I deep down didn't believe it. I kind of felt like a fraud. But these young people have all their life, when they said, "I want to go to college, I want to be a doctor," I've had people say, "Oh, I don't think you can do that. You don't have papers." And most of us, if we were told that, would have believed it. We would have gotten discouraged and veered off the path. And these young people did not. So they bring that immigrant spirit that will achieve, that overcomes obstacles, that has great resilience. And so they are going to be great physicians, and they are going to be leaders for change in our healthcare system. And so I think that their future is bright. The thing, though, that I need to add to this, though, is DACA has a limitation. It was implemented by President Obama. It was announced on June 15th of 2012, and you had to be in this country already at that point for 5 continuous years. So they had to have arrived prior to June 15th of 2007. And nobody who arrived after that is eligible for DACA. So that means that the average college student who is undocumented in the U.S. is not eligible for DACA. They're still just undocumented without the ability to work lawfully. And so they're slugging away and cannot apply to the Stritch School of Medicine because we could educate them, but we can't get them onto residency. There's no pathway. So we need Congress to act or the president to revise the executive order. But of course, that's going to face court challenges. This is a DACA is still being challenged in the courts. But we need a pathway for these young people because at a certain point, none of the undocumented students who have all these same great characteristics are going to be joining our physician workforce. We're just simply going to be wasting this talent of people who grew up here and have this great resiliency and drive and achievement. And if that isn't injustice, I don't know what is.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kosheski. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to have you today on Bioethics in the Margins, and congratulations on your award, and thank you for all your advocacy for DACA recipients and advocacy on other immigration matters. And thank you also for your scholarly output. And we appreciate your thoughts and insights today about nonprofit hospitals straying from their mission.
And thank you for having me and for all your work on this podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.